Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo 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 Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So I know that where this book is open to is not where we are. Where are you?
1824-25.
Okay, that's where we are. Ekada dhanur udyamya vicharan mrugayam vane mrugan anugataha shantaha shudhitas trishito prusham Jalashayam, Achakshanaha, Pravivesha, Tam, Ashramam, Tadarsha, Munim, Asinam, Shantam, Milita, Lochanam, Ekada Dhanur Udyamya, Vicharan mrigayam vane Nagan anugata shanta Shudhitas trishito brisham Chalashayam achakshanaha Pravivesha tamashramam Tadarsha munimasinam Shantam milita lochanam Ekada dhanurudyamya Vicharan mrigayam vane Nagan anugata shanta Shudhitas trishito brisham Chalashayam achakshanaha Pravivesha tamashramam Tadarsha munimasinam Shantam milita lochanam Someone else?
Ekada dhanurudyamya
Ekada dhanurudyamya
Once upon a time.
Dhanuhu.
Arrows and bow.
Udyamya.
Taking firmly. Vicharan.
Following.
Mrugayam.
Hunting excursion.
Vane.
In the forest.
gone
status
anugataha
while following
shrantaha
fatigue
shuditaha
hungry
trishataha
being thirsty
prasham
extremely
chala
ashayam
reservoir of water
achakshanaha
while searching for
pravivesha
entered into
tam
that famous
ashramam
hermitage of
Shamik
Rishi
the darsha
saw
munim
the sage
asinam
seated
shantam
all
silent
nilita
closed
lochanam
eyes.
Once upon a time, Maharaj Parikshit, while engaged in hunting in the forest with bow and arrows, became extremely fatigued, hungry, and thirsty while following the stags. While searching for a reservoir of water, he entered the hermitage of the well-known Shamik Rishi and saw the sage sitting silently with closed eyes. Purport. The Supreme Lord is so kind to his pure devotees that in proper time he calls such devotees up to him and thus creates an auspicious circumstance for the devotee. Maharaj Parikshit was a pure devotee of the Lord, and there was no reason for him to become extremely fatigued, hungry, and thirsty, because a devotee of the Lord never becomes perturbed by such bodily demands. But by the desire of the Lord, even such a devotee can become apparently fatigued and thirsty, just to create a situation favorable for his renunciation of worldly activities. One has to give up all attachment for worldly relations before one is able to go back to Godhead. And thus, when a devotee is too much absorbed in worldly affairs, the Lord creates a situation to cause indifference. The Supreme Lord never forgets his pure devotee, even though he may be engaged in so-called worldly affairs. Sometimes he creates an awkward situation, and the devotee becomes obliged to renounce all worldly affairs. The devotee can understand by the signal of the Lord, but others take it to be unfavorable and frustrating. Maharaj Parikshit was to become the medium for the revelation of Srimad Bhagavatam by Lord Sri Krishna, as his grandfather Arjuna was the medium for the Bhagavad Gita. Had Arjuna not been taken up with an illusion of family affection by the will of the Lord, the Bhagavad Gita would not have been spoken by the Lord himself for the good of all concerned. Similarly, had Maharaj Parikshit not been fatigued, hungry, and thirsty at this time, Srimad Bhagavatam would not have been spoken by Srila Shukadeva Goswami, the prime authority of Srimad Bhagavatam. So this is a prelude to the circumstances under which Srimad Bhagavatam was spoken for the benefit of all concerned. The prelude, therefore, begins with the words, "Once upon a time."
Om Jyoti Mirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Sthapitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupakada Mahyam Tathati Tapadantikam Bandeham Sri Guru, Sri Jata Patakamalam, Sri Guru Vaishnavamscha, Sri Rupam Sagrajatam, Sahagana Raganatan Vitam Stam Sajivam, Sadvaitam Savatutam, Parijana Sahitam, Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Dadita Sri Vishakhanditamscha Hey Krishna Kurana Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kamshana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Prasabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Maripye Vansha Kopitarubhyascha Kripa Sindho Bhyayivacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Ekada Dhanur Udyamya Vicharan Mrigayam Vane Mrigan Anugata Shranta Shuditas Trishito Dusham Jalashayam Chakshanaha Pravivesha Tamashramam Dadarsha Munimasinam Shantam Militalochana. The first question that might come up is what Maharaj Pariksit was doing hunting animals to begin with. No, serious question. The kings were allowed to hunt animals because their duty was to protect the society from violent elements. So the kings had to use violence also. The violence is not bad. It's just a question of how you use it. A knife can, cutting a person with a knife is violent or helpful, depending on whether you're a thief or a surgeon. The cutting has its proper utility. So the violence has its proper use for protecting human society. When there are thieves and muggers, then you want a policeman who's violent. You don't want a policeman who comes and says, you know, you really shouldn't do that. You know, this is really not the right thing to do. No, you want a guy who comes with a gun and says, you take your hands off that man or I'm going to blow your head off. That's what you want. You want someone powerful. A violent priest or a non-violent policeman is the wrong thing to have. So because the kings had to use violence, because they had to fight, they had to stay in shape and practice. You don't always get real-life dacoits to fight with, but you have to be ready for them when they show up. So the kshatriyas were allowed to hunt in the forest, not in the modern cowardly way where you hide behind a blind and you wait for an animal to come, and when it's 100 yards away, you get him in your sights and blow him away with a shotgun. But with bow and arrow, or even hand to hand, in the museum in Jaipur, you can see things like tiger knives, which is a kind of very sharp, very powerful little knife that a kshatriya would hold in his hand while doing battle with a tiger. And tigers are serious business. None of us, I think, would want to do hand-to-hand or paw-to-paw combat with a tiger. But the kshatriyas used to do it. So they were serious about military prowess. And so Parikshit Maharaj, Ekada, once upon a time, went out to hunt. Ekada, not that he opened a slaughterhouse and was killing animals as a regular business, or even going out every day to kill them. But sometimes the Kshatriyas would hunt for the sake of their staying current, staying strong in their readiness to perform their duties. Ekada dhanarudyamya vicharan mrigayam vane mrigan anugata shanta kshuritas trishito grisham. And on this occasion he became exceedingly shanta, fatigued. Fatigued, shanta, and kshuritas and trishita, hungry and thirsty. And that was unusual also, because the Kshatriyas would have powerful stamina. They wouldn't just tire out. But this was all an arrangement by Krishna, that the king would become tired, thirsty, hungry, jalashayam achakshana, and he'd be looking for a place where there was water, pravivesha tamashrama, and he would enter an ashram, a place of spiritual culture, a hermitage, and there he would see a muni. Muni is a sage. Nidarsha munim asinam shantam militalochana, practicing yoga. In the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, we learn about the Ashtanga yoga system, the system of yoga practiced in previous ages for attaining spiritual perfection. It involves sitting in a proper place. Shucho deshe pratishthapya sthiram asanam atmanam natyutritam natinicham trilajana pushottara. The yogi has to go to a sacred place, not a gymnasium in a crowded city, but off somewhere in the forest or by the bank of the Ganges. And he has to put down an asana, a seat, which is not too high, not too low, where there's, first of all, he puts kusha grass, a particular kind of grass, and a deer skin and a soft cloth. And then he sits on that seat very firmly with his neck and back and body erect and with his eyes fixed on the tip of the nose, neither completely open or completely closed, and withdrawing his attention from everything external and focusing all of his attention within. Because the purpose of the yoga system is to find the super soul, to find Krishna within the heart. Dhyana vastita tad gatena manasa pashyanti yam yogi. The yogis were actually able to see Krishna within the heart, just as we're able to see the deity. The yogis were able to see the super soul within their hearts by meditation, and they would become absorbed in that meditation and oblivious of everything external. So this muni was practicing meditation, and therefore when Parikshit Maharaj came in, the muni didn't even see him. Didn't notice. We see that sometimes someone becomes absorbed in something. You're reading a book and you don't even notice when somebody comes in because you're so absorbed in the novel or whatever it might be. Or you're absorbed in solving a mathematical problem or listening to music or writing something. And you're so absorbed that people
someone may come or go, you don't even notice. That's the nature of inner absorption. Hypnosis is also like that. The person's attention is directed inwardly, and he can become so focused that whatever else is going on around him, he doesn't notice. It has no effect. So this is withdrawal of attention, external attention, and concentration of the mind within. So when the sage was meditating in that way, he didn't even notice when Parikshit Maharaj came in. Parikshit Maharaj was searching for water, and he expected naturally that when he entered the hermitage, he'd be offered at least a glass of water. But he was offered nothing because the sage was out of commission, as it were. And as we'll find in later verses, the king became angry at the sage. What kind of cold reception is this? And insulted him also, which was very unusual for a pious king like Parikshit Maharaj, because the Kshatriyas used to give great respect to the Brahmins. The Brahmins served as the spiritual guide for the society, and under their guidance, the Kshatriyas would protect and administer the society. So it was most unusual that the king would respond in such a rude way. And therefore, how are we to explain it? The Srila Prabhupada tells us that this was all arranged by Krishna. Sometimes Krishna arranges things in the life of a devotee to achieve some particular purpose. Here we find that one purpose was a public welfare objective. The Lord wanted the Srimad Bhagavatam to be presented to human society, and Maharaj Parikshit was to serve as the original hearer for the Bhagavatam, the original, yes, hearer and inquirer for whom the Srimad Bhagavatam would be spoken. And then the rest of the world, including us, would get the benefit. The same thing occurred with the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna arranged for Arjuna to be placed in a conundrum, to be placed in perplexity, under a kind of illusion that these are my family members, these are my teachers and friends, how can I oppose them in battle? So that was Krishna's arrangement, so that the Bhagavad Gita would be spoken and we would get the benefit. So Krishna sometimes arranges things for the benefit of the people in general. And there's another dimension to this, that Krishna arranged it for the benefit of Maharaj Parikshit personally. Because he was a king, and king means entanglement. You've got a palace, you've got a queen, you've got a lot of money, you've got a lot of stuff. You're the big man in the country. Everyone's sucking up to you for favors. Everyone's saying how great you are. Everyone says, yes, your majesty, no, your majesty, as you wish, your majesty. And the tendency is to be quite, to get carried away by these things. Also to think, all these people are depending on me. If I don't see to the welfare of the state, if I don't see to the welfare of the treasury, if I don't see that justice is being done, if I don't make sure these ministers are kept in check, if I don't see to this, if I don't see to that,
everything will go to the dogs. So I have to do this. Everyone is depending on me. One starts to think in that way, that actually everything depends on me. Everything depends on me. If I were out of the scene, what would happen? Political figures think that way. That if I were to step down from my post, what would happen to the state of Michigan? Businessmen think that way. If I were to step down as CEO, who knows what the next guy would do with the company? Of course, I have to step down eventually, but they're not ready yet. I have to stay a while longer and make sure things go on. Practically everyone thinks that they're in one way or another indispensable, that their work is important, their responsibilities cannot be, he can't be replaced. If I don't do this, what will happen? Who else has this kind of expertise? Who else has this kind of vision? Who else understands the way this works? So one is reluctant to hand over responsibility. Or even one thinks, if I hand over these duties, what will I do? All right, they're ready to take it over, but if I hand all this over, I'm redundant. I have no function. I'm not necessary. We sometimes find that people, even in their old age, are reluctant to step down, not because there's no one to take their place, but because they're afraid. What will happen to me? What will I do? Sometimes people even retire, and after some short time in retirement, they come back because their life seemed meaningless. They had a good time on the golf course for a few days, a few weeks, a few months. They sort of settled into retired life. And then they felt like, what am I doing here? I'm just vegetating. I'm not accomplishing anything. And I was happier when I was working. So they go back. Because they have no higher objective in life. All they know is work and work and work and work and be busy and be in the center of things and make things happen and tell this guy off and straighten this guy out. Cut the next deal. Move the company to the next step. That's all they know. And a higher purpose in life, their purpose is just to keep working and enjoy their work or enjoy the results of their work. But they have no higher goal in life. And because they have no higher goal, they don't want to give up what they have. They don't want to give up what they have. Because they have no higher goal, or because they're under the illusion that everything depends on them. One way or another way, or because they're ready to step down, but people around them are saying, no, we need you. We're still depending on you, Jack. So even if he's ready to go, no, we're not ready to see you go. So for one reason, another reason, or a third reason, or other reasons,
one sticks to one's position and remains wrapped up in the circle of family, home, business, colleagues. And one, with one's attention focused on that, where is the opportunity for spiritual realization? Maybe if he's an effective executive, he's got a little corner there for his spiritual life also. Whichever quadrant that's supposed to be in, he's got it there. And he does his whatever it is, his prayers or his puja or his worship. Or his, so he's got that in there too. He's charitable. He's giving to the church or the Salvation Army or Food for Life or something. So that's all there. He's got a whole life. It's all complete. But death is approaching him. And he's not prepared. He doesn't have a clear understanding of what comes next, nor is he, does he feel the urgency of preparing for that transition before it comes. Transition means tata dehantara prapti. At the time of death, I have to leave this body and accept another body. And that's when everything's tested. At the time of death, we'll see how well we did in our life. Just as at the time of your final examination, it's tested how well you did in your studies. And then your next, how qualified you are for your next destination, or what destination you're qualified for, is determined. Whether you're fit to go on to graduate school, or whether you're fit to take on a job in a big company, or whether you bomb out and have to go through the whole thing again, or just forget it, you're just not meant for this, you're not cut out for it, you've tried this too many times and it's just not working. It's all tested at the end. So our human life is meant for spiritual realization. Brahmajigyasa. And how well we've accomplished the mission of human life is tested at the time of death. And as a rule, we're putting it off. We're going to cram for it at the last minute. But Krishna is so kind that when someone is a sincere devotee, Krishna arranges some circumstance to upset the apple cart, to take our nice arrangements and blow them up, to dislodge us from the hole we've crawled into, and kick us out into reality. That's Krishna's kindness. That's Krishna's kindness. And to others it may seem, oh, this person's life is a disaster. Did you hear what happened to such and such? How terrible. Why him? He was such a nice person. But the devotee takes it as good fortune. Krishna has kindly kicked me out of my illusion. He's kicked me out of my comfortable situation. He's arranged things in such a way that I have to come face to face with reality, or so that I have the opportunity now to focus on my real purpose, going back home, back to Godhead. That's Krishna's special kindness.
yasyaham manugranami harishe tadanamchana. Generally, we try to build things up, to pull things together. But when Krishna especially favors a devotee, he blows it apart. He takes everything away so that the devotee is smashed, and then the devotee tries to build it up again. Krishna smashes him again. And he builds him up, smashes him down, till finally the devotee says, I surrender. And that makes his life fully successful. I take away his money. Generally, smashing someone means taking away his money. Now so many people are feeling smashed. Their money has been... What's the word? It's been devalued, yeah. It's cut to ribbons. It's turned into water. Their investments have become a penny to the dollar. Excuse me? Yeah, sometimes our health gets smashed. Our bank account gets smashed. Our health gets smashed. Our job gets smashed. Our relationship gets smashed. Our, you name it, Krishna can do it.
Reputation.
Our reputation gets smashed. Our respectability. Our position is taken away. Sometimes Krishna just tears us up. And the devotee can recognize the signal, Prabhupada said. He sees that Krishna is being very kind to me. Rather than let me wallow in material illusion or be comfortably situated, Krishna's waking me up while the opportunity is good. Because later, I don't know. I think I'll do this in my old age. But we don't know that we're going to have an old age. Our old age might be now. Or we don't know where we're going to be in our old age. You meet people, they're in their old age. They're gone. They're already, there's no one home. The dendrites have all died out. The synapses are no longer functioning. Everything is gone. It's just maybe they can lie in bed and watch television and be kept happy and comfortable. But they can't inquire about the purpose of life or who they are, why they are. They may have been great scholars or doctors or professors or what have you. But now they're like babies. You know, the staff comes and changes their diapers. So we don't know that we have a future in which we're going to be able to inquire about spiritual realization. And therefore, Vedanta says, atato brahma jigyasa, one should inquire now. Now is the time for spiritual realization. So Parikshit Maharaj got exceptional mercy from Krishna. And we also receive exceptional mercy from Krishna in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam, spoken by Sukadeva Goswami to Maharaj Parikshit just on the verge of the king's death. So maybe we'll stop here and see what kind of questions there might be. Sometimes, isn't what happens to us just Krishna, the arrangement of nature, of karma? I did something, and so now I'm getting the result for it. So why do we say, well, Krishna is involved? There are two things. First is that even behind the karma, it's Krishna's arrangement. Even ordinary cause and effect, even ordinary action and reaction, is by Krishna's arrangement. So if I did something stupid and now I'm getting the reaction for it, that's also Krishna's mercy.
That's also Krishna. He's arranged the whole setup. So even ordinary karma is coming from Krishna. But beyond that, sometimes there are just exceptional circumstances. You can't account for it. The king was pious, he was self-controlled, he was endowed with all good qualities. How can you explain why, first of all, he would tire out in the middle of hunting, and second of all, insult a sage, a Muni? It's inexplicable. It makes no sense. It doesn't compute. So it's taken as Krishna's special intervention. When Arjuna fell into illusion at the battlefield of Kurukshetra, why would he do that? He was a kshatriya, he was powerful, he wasn't a sentimental kind of a person. For him suddenly to go soft was not expected. So it was Krishna's special arrangement. Krishna's special arrangement.
So the only devotees can perceive that?
Yeah, devotees see Krishna's arrangement everywhere. And non-devotees see Krishna's arrangement nowhere.
we are following Krishna, like some other religion, like those who are following any other Judaism. So they don't feel that there is so much economic crisis. Everything. Is it like the Jewish?
No, anyway, it's not a question of Jewish or Christian or Hindu. Any person, if he's a little bit sensitive to spiritual reality, he'll get the sign, well, this world is not as secure as I thought it was. And there's at a time like this, well, yeah, I can try and put my business together, but really everything's dependent on a higher power here. Anyone who's spiritually sensitive will understand that. And a person who's materially fixated, no matter how bad it gets, he'll think, no, I can still get it, I can still win. You know, a dullard, no matter, you scream at him, there's a fire, and he still looks at you blank. And a smart person, when he just sees the first puff of smoke, he thinks, uh-oh, something's wrong. So a devotee is receptive. He's ready to receive the signal from Krishna at any moment. And a materialist, he'll go to his depth saying there was never any signal, and the world was unfair, there was no sign, and if there were any sort of God, at least there would have been a sign. If God had come down and tapped him on the shoulder and spoken to him, he still would have gone. Someone was cooking chapatis and burned them and said, well, you blamed it on Krishna. Prabhupada said, don't blame Krishna, it's you. So how are we supposed to understand these things? We'll find in this narration that Prikshit Maharaj took it as his own fault. He didn't think that, well, Krishna's arranged for me to insult this sage. Krishna is the one who made me. No, he took it as his own responsibility. That I'm so uncultured that I've insulted this sage. But he did take it as Krishna's kindness that Sukadev Goswami came. He didn't think, well, because I'm such a big king, naturally this rishi has come to enlighten me. When he screwed up, he took the responsibility as his own. And when there was some good fortune, he took it as Krishna's mercy. Something else? Kalkantapur?
There are people in religious organizations, maybe even one or two in ISKCON, who feel that whatever they do is divinely inspired.
People in religious organizations think that whatever they do is divinely inspired. Yeah, by especially by scripture. You know, I'm divinely inspired to do something which is totally against the direction of the standard authority. And we have to question your divine inspiration. Generally, those who are divinely inspired are divinely inspired to follow the instructions given by the scriptures, by the enlightened people. Not that they're divinely inspired to say, pack it all in, I've got a new idea. Divine inspiration, and one just rejects all the authorities. There are cases where one may act contrary to scriptural direction because of his mature understanding and his focus on the purpose of the scriptural instructions. The neophyte will say, well, no, I've got to, you know, I do this for a half hour, I do that for a half hour, then I throw six drops of water this way, and then I say, you know, a few six Hare Krishnas or two Hail Marys or whatever it is, and then, you know, that's what I'm supposed to do. And maybe as a regular function, that is what he's supposed to do. But when there's some higher consideration, you can toss all the rituals. Shuti vipradipanna te yadasta suti. What is that? It's in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says that when one becomes self-realized, then he's beyond the range of all these scriptural instructions. So that doesn't mean that this is what we look for. We look for people who just ditch the scriptures. Generally, Krishna says elsewhere, even the self-realized persons, perfected souls, follow the scriptural directions. But sometimes we find that the self-realized souls go beyond the range of these ordinary things for the sake of service to Krishna. For the sake of service to Krishna. Yes. But that doesn't mean just the gopis, they gave up all the usual standards of proper social behavior just to please Krishna. But it doesn't mean that we can just ditch everything. There's a Latin proverb, quod licet Jovi, non licet Domi. What's legal for Jove, the king of the gods, is not legal for the cow. That's the literal meaning. Something like rank has its privileges. But not exactly. It means that when you're on the platform of the highest spiritual prerogative, of the highest spiritual realization, then you can do so many things that the ordinary person can't do. Lord Shiva drank an ocean of poison. We can't do that. We can't imitate. So it's said that one should not imitate the great souls. One should follow them. One should follow them. Yes.
Spiritual master doesn't need our service. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, because I think it's I've been under a situation where it's like I have to do the service. You feel like it's almost like someone needs you, but the truth is that service is it's an opportunity for you to.
It's an opportunity. We should, of course, the sentiment is not bad that my spiritual master is depending on me to do this service. So I have to be dependable. But it's also a fact that if I don't do it, Krishna will send someone else. Prabhupada one time said, Krishna can create a million servitors like you in a second. He's not dependent on us. But still, for us to act as though Krishna were dependent, that is to say, to be responsible, that's good. But especially we find that there's, in the Vedic culture, one is meant to retire from family life, from business affairs. It's actually mandatory. You're 50 years old, retire. That's Vanaprastha Ashram. Get out. You don't have to wait for another sign. Just look at the calendar if you're 50 years old. Get out. Because the tendency is so strong. Well, no, they need me for this, they need me for that. You might die tomorrow. Then what are they going to do? So therefore, it's mandatory. Pancha shortam dhanam vidhe. Just get out.
If someone does not get retired at 50, so...
does not get...
If you see in your family that you are now only doing... I mean, someone gets below 50, so is it your response? If you are younger, you should suggest them... you should suggest them that you should take retirement, you should take an after.
Well, you have to see what your... The question is, if you see someone who's 50 and you're less than 50, do you start, delivering the message, hey, you old goat, what are you still doing in family life? You have to see what your adhikar is, what your eligibility is for giving such advice. The general etiquette is that the junior person should not advise the senior person. That's general good manners, general etiquette. But sometimes if the younger person is more advanced in spiritual realization, then he may even become, just like Sukadeva Goswami, he was 16 years old. And he's going to be sitting in this assembly with people who are literally hundreds of years old, great sages and venerable figures whose history in the Vedic epics is legendary. He's going to be sitting in an assembly like that and giving instruction. So sometimes it's said one becomes old by knowledge. So sometimes even a younger person may be the person to deliver the message. But we should be careful and a little hesitant before we go around to all of our seniors saying, hey, you old goat. It may not be appreciated.
No, I mean, like, one of my uncle is too old, he's maybe like 60, and I'm seeing from since the time I've got understanding, he's too much into the business, still is working. So what should be the approach? How should we approach? I mean, I'm not saying you go home, leave home and take.
No, it's a practical question that we see all around us, these, as Prabhupada called them, old fossils who won't leave the job until they're dragged out by death. So what do we say to them? This is, of course, a great issue even in mundane life. How do you break it to your parents or to your senior co-worker or senior employee even, that they can't drive anymore, or they're dangerous, that they're now screwing up the same business that they built up, now they're dragging it down. How do you get it across to them as humanely as possible that really, it's time for a change, it's time to move out? It's difficult. And what to speak of convincing people that they should do that for the sake of spiritual realization. So it's one adopts different tactics, one tries to gently suggest, one tries to point things out, one slips a copy of First Canto Srimad Bhagavatam in his
drawer and says, here's a book that's really interesting. I think you might like this. One way or another, one tries to get it across. And sometimes even one crosses the lines of good manners for the sake of helping someone. The example is given that someone's flying a kite from the roof and is going to just about ready to fall off. So that's not the time for etiquette and decorum. Pardon me, sir, but has it occurred to you that you're only a foot and a half from the edge of the roof, and the likelihood is that if you're not careful, you're not. Hey! You know, you may call him all sorts of names, anything to get his attention, because otherwise the guy's going to fall and break his neck. So for the sake of enlightening others, we may put aside all decorum, all good manners, all etiquette, all everything. That should be done with discretion. That should be done with some discretion. But actually the Krishna conscious person tries to do that. He tries to give everyone the message of Krishna. Vidura is a good example. He was the younger brother of Dhritarashtra, and Dhritarashtra was the king also. Vidura was only the prime minister, and that also he left aside. But when he came back after the battle of Kurukshetra and saw his older brother mired in material attachment, living a degraded life at the expense of the people he tried to murder, Vidura just let him have it. You're blind from birth, and your teeth are falling out, your hearing's going to hell, and your liver's not working. You're just on the verge of death, and still you're such a fool that you're parading around like the elder statesman of Hastinapur. Just get out. Don't live like a dog like this. So really let him have it, because nothing else would work. Nothing else would work on that old man. So Vidura just, both barrels, gave it to him. So that's sometimes needed. But just think about what you're doing. Be careful.
But what one does when he retires, I mean, because he has been yet detached from his desires, so...
Vanam gato yad harim ashrayeta. He takes shelter of Krishna. Now, in practical terms, they used to go to the forest and practice austerities and penances. That's difficult now. You tell certain, you know, I know that you're the CEO of such and such company, but really, wouldn't it be better if you went to the forest and lived on roots and berries? They're not going to do that. But there are alternatives. There are holy places all over India, for example, you can go, or now all over America, there are temples, there are places dedicated to cultivation of Krishna consciousness, and you can go from place to place. And by traveling to these places, you purify your heart, you get free from all the stuff that you were doing, all the entanglements, and it's amazing how insignificant those things were. As soon as you take off, you know, like everything goes on without you. People make up for your absence or celebrate, they throw a party. And you have new freedom. But you travel from place to place and you become purified by hearing the message of Krishna, by seeing the deity of Krishna, by rendering service to Krishna. Or you can go to one place like Vrindavan or Mayapur and cultivate Krishna consciousness there. Just giving up your home and living in the forest is not such a credit. Prabhupada points out that the monkeys live there also. And they're not known for great spiritual advancement. But the real purpose is to become, to make progress in Krishna consciousness. Yes?
I always find it a challenge to, when I see that Krishna's message, something I'm doing, is to put more determination of doesn't want me to do it. So
Krishna makes it hard for you to accomplish something, and
yeah. How do I know if I need to put more determination?
How do we know if something's failing? How do we know whether we need to put more energy into it or give up? How do we know which Krishna wants? Well, first we may consult the spiritual master. You want me to keep working at this? And that solves your question right there if he tells you. Or we may consult senior persons, senior advisors, senior devotees. Or Srila Prabhupada's formula sometimes was try for it. And if you tried and it didn't work out, then we might take it that, all right, Krishna didn't desire, and we go on to the next thing. But then sometimes Srila Prabhupada would take it the other way, that despite all obstacles, he would stick. Bombay, example. Bombay Temple. So that, again, our maturity in Krishna consciousness will help us. By chanting Hare Krishna, by always being engaged in service, you become receptive to Krishna's direction. You become purified so that you'll know what to do. You take direction from scripture, you take direction from the spiritual master or sadhus. And finally, because you are purified, Krishna tells you what to do. Okay, that looks like the final indication. Should we do that?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm attached to my post to the last minute.
We have grapes, bananas, oranges, apples. We have grapes, steel, puff rice. Grapes is probably good. What about some nuts? Some raisins?
No. Try just business.
Okay. Yeah, grapes will be okay.
Yes, where's that next question coming from? Yes.
Did Prabhupada
want all of us to take vanaprastha? At the appropriate time, it seems that he did intend that. If you read his books again and again and again and again and again and again and again, he mentions this point that one should retire timely from family life. At first, you know, when I was reading these things as a young brahmachari, surrounded by other young brahmacharis, I took it that these are the instructions that we're meant to assimilate so that we can instruct the materialistic people, the karmis. And now, I can also see that they're meant for us. That even for devotees, giving up the connection of family life is not so easy. The attachment to wife and home and family, feeling that others are depending on me, the feeling that I have responsibility, and the feeling that I can't artificially put these things aside, that I have to, or just a feeling of fear or apprehension, what would I do, where will I go, who will take care of me, what about my medical expenses, what about this, what about that. These things are very strong, and therefore even devotees need to take it very seriously, or need to be reminded sometimes that this is not just for them, it's for us. Yes?
When the time of, say, one vanaprastha has come, we should be prepared for that and not just like, since I'm 50, I should take vanaprastha, not that. When the time for vanaprastha comes, like, I should know, like, I should be prepared for that. It's not that, like, when 50 age comes, that I should take.
Yeah, you should be prepared. That means that brahmachari life is there as the foundation of human life, as the foundation of spiritual culture. So that when you get married, you're equipped with the spiritual training and spiritual vision, so that in your family life, you have a proper balance between material and spiritual activities. And then when it comes time to pack it in and retire, you have the resources, spiritual resources, to draw upon to accomplish that. If you never cultivated spiritual life before, then to look at the calendar and say, well, I'm 50, I guess I should retire, it's not going to work.
On the other hand, it's not that we should say, well, I'm 50, but I never had enough spiritual training, and I was never very strong as a householder and spiritually speaking, and it would be artificial for me, and da 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 da. Excuses, excuses.
And how to monitor our spiritual progress, because for that to happen, I should regularly monitor what is happening in my spiritual life, how am I progressing.
How to monitor it? That's up to you, how you monitor it. Bhakti No Thakur had some system, what is it, once in a month or something, take a count of, you know, that's up to you as a how you want to monitor what you're doing in your life, what works for you, whether you stop every Wednesday and see how you did the past week, or, you know, I can't tell you how to monitor your progress. I can tell you what some of the markers are. You see whether you're following the four regular principles seriously, whether you're chanting your standard number of rounds, whether you're avoiding 10 kinds of offenses in chanting, whether your time is being wasted or whether it's being spent seriously in Krishna's service. These are some of the, whether your eagerness to hear about Krishna and chant about Krishna is increasing or decreasing. Something else.
Another question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can have two.
Mind and intelligence are material elements. But you also say purifier heart. So what is the position of heart? Like, is it
heart,
a material element?
There's a word in Sanskrit, chitta. And it serves for heart. It serves for mind. It serves for consciousness. Like if you say, I can't get that girl out of my heart. Means you can't get her out of your heart, you can't get her out of your mind, you can't get her out of your consciousness. You know, we're not going to do a strict physical inventory and find out whether it's here that you can't get her out of or here that you can't get her out of. We understand that the meaning is that one's consciousness is absorbed in thinking of this girl. So that's chitta, that's consciousness, heart, mind. It's translated any of those ways.
Because actually, like, I read in chapter 2, our heart, the soul lies in the heart, and the energy of all the body is coming from the heart. From there, we just feel directed. So, something special, the soul also has heart or not?
Yes, the soul, first of all, the soul is in the physical. In the physical heart, that's the location of the soul. But then, does the soul have a heart? The soul has a heart, but the heart is not different from the rest of the soul. We're in the present embodied state, we're like mechanical contraptions, and this is here and that's there, and it's all, if this breaks, that doesn't work, and so on. The soul is not the same sort of electro-hydraulic pneumatic machine. It's different. Do we stop now? Is this the final end? This is the final end. All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. All glories to you.